We're finishing up our stewardship journey. We've been talking about stewardship, but really what we've been talking about is discipleship. I want to begin by asking you a question. What is a Christian? What does it mean to call somebody a Christian? Think about that to yourselves. How would you describe that? Sometimes people say, well, I'm a believer. Sometimes people say, I'm a Christian. Sometimes people say, I belong to a church. I'm a member of a church. What is a Christian? The most common word used in the New Testament to describe somebody who's connected to Jesus is a disciple. A disciple is not a religious word. It was used to mean lots of things, not just following God. It could be you were a disciple of other people. Let me give you some examples, some modern examples. If you want to play the piano well, you find a teacher, and that teacher disciples you in music. You surrender yourself to that teacher's instruction. So when she says, practice your scales, or practice at all, you practice. When I was a kid, I took a few piano lessons, and that was the key. Practice. And that was the key why I don't play today, not practicing. But if you learn your scales and practice your scales, then your teacher will give you some simple music to learn. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. And you begin to get your feet under you and begin to understand, and you begin to play and gain proficiency. Then she says, okay, now that you've been practicing your scales and practicing the songs, we're going to have a recital. And you're going to learn how to perform in front of people. And that's a part of becoming a musician. Because to be a musician really is not something you do alone. It's something you do in front of people. And so you gain experience. And as you surrender to that teacher, you become a better musician. Think of it in athletics. If somebody wants to be an accomplished gymnast, she finds a good coach. And that coach says, okay, you need to stretch. You need to do these exercises to limber yourself up. And then you need to begin working out with weights so that you can be stronger to do some of the difficult, procedures for gymnast. Obviously, I'm not a gymnast. As an athlete submits to that teacher and allows that teacher to disciple him or her, that person becomes a better athlete, becomes a better gymnast. But it requires submitting to the teacher and doing what the teacher says, practicing. I was talking to Sonia at the middle service. And I said, what do you call a pianist who goes to the lessons but doesn't practice? And she said, a poor pianist. And when we talk about what it means to be a Christian, we talk about discipleship. As we've gone through these couple of weeks previously about going through Mark's gospel, we've looked at some ways the disciples and other people try and understand and try and talk about what it means to follow Jesus. And what you often find is that people don't do very well at following him. The disciples often don't understand what it means. Other people, you know, one fellow is trying to, the Pharisees ask Jesus, what about divorce? And it becomes very clear they're looking for loopholes. They're not trying to keep God's word. They're trying to get around it. The disciples also at times just don't seem to get it. We've been talking about discipleship the last 3 weeks, the two previous weeks and now this week. 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the discipleship of possessions. We looked at the story of the young man who came to Jesus and said, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said, "Keep the commandments." And the guy said, "I've done that." Jesus says, "One thing you lack. Sell all you have, give it to the poor, and you'll be rich in heaven. And then come and follow me." And he wasn't willing to. He wasn't willing to surrender to Jesus, to become a disciple of Jesus. And we said from that, if you want to follow Jesus, get stuff out of the way, because sometimes our stuff gets in the way of our relationship with Jesus. And if we want to really follow him, it requires letting go of some things, getting them out of the way. Last week we talked about the discipleship of greatness or power. And Jesus had just told the disciples he's going to be arrested, killed, and rise from the dead in 3 days afterwards. And John and James immediately, it seems, say, "Hey, Jesus, come here. When you get into your glory, can we be top dogs on your cabinet? Can we be at the top of the food chain? Can we be at the top of the ladder?" And Jesus has to say, "Listen, you don't get it. Even I came not to be served, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for many. If you want to be great in the kingdom, you're last. If you want to be great in the kingdom, in God's eyes, you'll be servant of all." And we said greatness in the kingdom is not getting, but giving. And now in this part of Mark's gospel, it seems that Jesus is trying to, or Mark is trying to sort of put an exclamation point on that and to help us understand what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be following Jesus. And so he tells this story about a blind man being healed. What's interesting is that at the middle of chapter 8, there was another healing of a blind man. And in that one, it didn't work. So Jesus takes this guy out who's blind out of town, and he spits in the ground in the dirt and makes some mud and puts it on the guy's eyes. And he says, "Can you see?" And he says, "Well, I see people, but they're like trees walking around." I want to say, "Well, take the mud off first." But apparently that's not what happened. Jesus has to do it again. And then he sees clearly. And it seems to be preparing us for these stories that people don't see and understand Jesus. And now in this story of a man who is blind and then sees immediately, we find somebody who gets Jesus, who really does see, who really does understand. So I think this story is, I think it's a literal healing, but I think it's placed here as a way of teaching us, as a metaphor for discipleship. So let's look at the passage. They came to Jericho. As he and his disciples and a large crowd were leaving Jericho, Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, a blind beggar, was sitting by the roadside. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout out and say, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Many sternly ordered him to be quiet, but he cried out even more loudly, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stood still and said, "Call him here." And they called the blind man, saying to him, "Take heart, get up, he is calling you." So throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. Then Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" The blind man said to him, "Teacher, let me see again." Jesus said to him, "Go, your faith has made you well." Immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the way. So let's sort of dissect that and go back through it and try and understand what's going on. In the next chapter, chapter 11, we are at the triumphal entry. Jesus entering Jerusalem for Passover week. And so in this passage, everybody else is heading to Jerusalem along with Jesus. And so Bartimaeus is a beggar. And he knows where he needs to be to get good receipts, to get good revenue. And I imagine very early that morning, or maybe even in the middle of the night, he can get around. Blind people don't have problems with darkness. And I imagine he got there one of the first ones to find the best place to beg, because he knows now's the time. During Passover, it's one of the three pilgrimage feasts of people going to Jerusalem, so there'll be a lot of people. He can make some cash. He can make some money today and this week. So he gets there early and gets his spot, and he's begging. I imagine he's crying out to people, "Bless you, God bless you, God cares for the poor, God blesses those who care for the poor." And he's trying to get money. And then he finds out that Jesus of Nazareth is coming by. And apparently he knows something about Jesus and has heard something about Jesus. So he starts crying out. And he calls Jesus the Messiah, Son of David. He's showing something about his trust in Jesus, what he believes about Jesus. And he cries out, people yell, "Shut up, leave him alone." But it doesn't stop him. He's persistent, and he cries out again. And what's interesting is that Jesus doesn't say, "Hey, where is that guy?" Jesus says, "Call him to me. Tell him to come to me." Would you make a blind man get up and try and find you in a crowd? But Jesus does. And do you notice what he does? He throws off his cloak. His cloak would have been the only thing he owned in all likelihood. It's what kept him warm last night and protected him from the sun during the day. And he just throws it away, cast it aside, and he goes to Jesus. And you know what happened as soon as he got up? Somebody took his place, because that was one of the good spots. And Bartimaeus was willing to give it up to go to Jesus, because he believed in Jesus. He put his trust in Jesus. And he comes to Jesus, and Jesus very wisely asks, "What do you want?" Because it's not always clear what people want. When people come into my office, they often have an agenda. They want to talk to me about something. And I rarely know what it is. And the best thing I can do is not begin talking, but to ask, "What can I do for you? Tell me why you're here." And Jesus does the same. And he says something I didn't really expect. "I want to see again." This is not a man born blind. There's a story of a man born blind in John's gospel. And he didn't lose anything. He was always blind. But this man at one time saw and lost his sight and lost his independence, lost his ability to earn money, and became a beggar because of his blindness. And he says, "I want to see again. Give me back my sight." And Jesus says, "Go." Other translations say, "Go on your way. Your faith has made you whole, has made you well." Where would you go if you were a blind beggar who received sight? I'd go to my family. I'd go to my parents or my children or my wife to say, "I'm back. I can begin to be a part of the family again. I can do more than I ever could before. But he doesn't. Immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the way to Jerusalem, on the way to the cross. I think in some ways Mark is saying this is a model for us. He gets up. He goes to Jesus. Those are marks of faith. Those are marks of trust. But then what happens? He follows Jesus. And of course, he literally follows him. But for us, that is to be metaphorically, because disciples, people who are Christians, are those who follow Jesus. So the question isn't, do you believe in Jesus? Although that's an important question. And Bartimaeus did, and I believe you do. And Bartimaeus went to Jesus, and you have come to Jesus. Most of you are members of this church, and you're here because you are drawn to Jesus. You've come to him. That's not the question. The question is, will you follow? Will you actually be shaped by Jesus? Will your life be, will you be mentored by him? Will you be nurtured by him? Will you be guided by him in the decisions of your life, in the way you spend your money, not what you, just what you give away, but what you spend, on the way you spend your time, the way you spend your entertainment, the things you watch, the things you read? Are you following Jesus there? One of my most memorable books was The Curate's Awakening, written by George MacDonald, who wrote in the 1800s and wrote children's stories. I think he wrote Back of the North Wind, something like that. And he tells this story of a young minister in the Church of England, Thomas Wingfold. And he's gone into the ministry because it was the best option. You know, in those times, if you weren't the firstborn son got the estate. The others got to be lawyers or politicians or soldiers or priests. Those were the honorable professions for them. And so he said, I'll become a priest. His uncle was a priest, and he had given him his sermons. And every Sunday he was reading his uncle's sermons. So I guess he thought it was an easy job. And then somebody asked him, do you really believe this? And that question began to work on him. And he began to question, am I a Christian? And I don't recommend this to do this in for other preachers. But this guy, during a sermon, got up and said this. All at once, my conscience awoke and asked me, have I today done a single thing Jesus has said to me? When was the last time I did something I heard from him? Did I ever in all my life do one thing because he said to me, do this? And the answer was, no, never. He's saying, I'm not a Christian. I don't recommend pastors do that in sermons. But I do recommend that everybody ask that question of themselves. Because a Christian is someone who not only gets up and goes to, but actually follows Jesus. Thomas Naylor taught at Duke University, taught business management. And when he would get students in a class, he would always ask them to develop a strategic plan. What are your goals for life? What do you want to accomplish? And how are you going to get there? And there were always, he said, with almost no exception, everybody wrote down three things: money, power, and things, usually big things like vacation homes, foreign automobiles, yachts, and sometimes even airplanes. That's their plan. That's what makes them a success. That's where they're heading to. And Jesus would say to them, don't aim so low, because those things are not important. Those things are not significant. In many ways, the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are guides to the good life. What a blessed, wonderful life looks like. And it looks like giving. It looks like serving. It looks like following Jesus. One person said, the idea, what it means to be a Christian is you try and live your life as if Jesus were in your shoes. So if Jesus had your job, you would do it the way he would do it. If Jesus were in your marriage, he would love your spouse the way you would love your spouse the way Jesus would love your spouse. In other words, you would be shaped and molded by Jesus. You would actually follow him. This morning, we're going to ask you to follow him in a concrete way. We're asking you to take one of those cards and bring it to the altar and reveal your following him in the financial realm. We're not asking you to write down the other ways that you're doing that, but I hope you'll begin to think about that. Am I serving God with my time? Am I shaped, or my priorities shaped by Jesus? But today we're asking you to do it in a concrete way to show that you're following him. If you know church finances very well, you know that the largest number of people, members of a church, give nothing. And many people give very little. I am asking you, because I think Jesus is asking you, to give generously. To reveal to yourself who you're following. So I invite you to come as an act of worship to the altar. The choir is going to begin, we're going to start singing Amazing Grace, where if you want to, you can turn to 378 and we'll sing it. But while we're singing it, we're inviting you to come. If you're a visitor here and you're not planning to give, we're disappointed, but we understand. But we still invite you to come to the altar to pray for our church and for the ministry of the church. So as we sing, come and come to the altar.